Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the International Biodynamic Guild podcast. I'm your host, Will Bratton, and today we're joined by David Sarita. David has worked with the Advanced Physics Corporation and NASA on nuclear fission technology. Fusion technology. He was appointed director of the LA-based Tesla Foundation by MIT PhD physics Bogdan Maglik, under which he spoke in Congress on non-radioactive fusion power in 1994. While president of High Energy Micro Devices, he worked with the Department of Defense in explosive device detection. He's worked with Lockheed Martin in space propulsion technology research and development, and he's also studied with the Dalai Lama in India and hand-planted 1.3 million trees throughout Canada. He's owner of Lightstream Breakthrough Technologies, and you can find him at davidsarita.co. Thanks for joining us, David.
Hey, thanks, Will. It's amazing. You know, your name, Will Bratton, is the name of one of the inventors of the transistor.
That's right. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, very few people know that. Cool. And before we get started, I do want to let the listeners know this is, of course, a biodynamic agriculturally themed show. And so I'm, from time to time, going to direct the subject towards those themes. And we're going to be getting into all sorts of very far out subjects. But just, you know, for our biodynamic listeners, just know we are going to bring it back to where these subjects intersect with biodynamics. So just so you aren't, expecting this to just be a show about space technology and otherwise high fusion technology. But David, you've got a very interesting background, and it was a challenge to try to write a bio for you that was, you know, short enough to start the show with. Can you kind of give us an overview of your life experiences and your path?
Well, I grew up, I mean, I was born in Canada in 1961, and there were four boys that my parents had. And we immediately after my fourth brother, Tim, was born, we moved to Berkeley, California, where my dad was studying to get a PhD in psychology. So we grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 60s, right in the middle of the Berkeley riots and the Vietnam War protests, and this massive transformational point in our history. And one day walking home from elementary school, it was called Cornell Elementary School, myself and a huge crowd of people assembled on the streets because there was a flying saucer up there. And so I would have been 7 or 8 years old and at the time. And this flying saucer was down low. It was lens-shaped, classic flying saucer. And this is pre-UFOlogy for me, because as a kid, I had no access to understanding space other than, you know, watching Star Trek and my favorite Martian. And it was also, my parents were in the middle of a divorce where my mom was going to marry a military man, David Cooper, and take all my brothers, you know, four boys with us into a whole new life. And so we went into that life and lost our real dad for, you know, 6 or 7 years. And then in 1972, you know, 73, we were with our real father again. And his, you know, both of my fathers, David Cooper and Lynn Sarita, had a huge impact on my life, because David Cooper became a science teacher and then a school administrator, a principal, and then a school administrator. And his interest in science and the Christmas presents he got me as a kid, like telescopes and things like that, and lab kits, got me really interested in science. But my dad got me into the science of the inner. And he introduced me and my brothers to meditation and yoga at, you know, as a 12 or 13 year old. And I slowly took to it. I started having mystical experiences doing these practices and hanging out with some of these realized meditation masters. And there were a lot of teachers that I met over the years. And I started to become rebellious in my school. I mean, I took physics and science and biology, and I presented a physics theory on time dilation to my teacher at the grade 12 physics level. And he said it was way, way over, you know, the grade level, and that it was correct. It lined up with Einstein's ideas on time dilation. And I became more interested in finding the truth, because everything took me back in my memory to the flying saucer. I've replayed that event millions of times in my mind, you know, throughout my life. And I wanted real answers. I wasn't satisfied with where mainstream education was going. And actually, in high school, I got offered, because I won Best Photographer of the Year in two different high schools, I got offered this scholarship. And I frankly just turned it down. It was a large scholarship, and I probably should have taken it in hindsight. But I was more passionate and in a hurry to discover what real enlightenment was, and doing very intensive meditation practices with my first girlfriend in our life for 3 years. I started having more and more and more experiences, and the experiences outweighed any of the benefits that modern civilization could offer. And one day in 1986, December 22nd and 23rd, I was taken out of body through the seven levels of heaven, speeding at superluminal speeds in my spirit body towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And the levels of ecstasy and bliss and perfection of mind were so utterly, they dwarf the human experience, utterly dwarf the human experience. And when you have experiences like that, you want more and more and more. And eventually, you know, when I started working for Magwitch, you know, I was pretty good at mathematics. I continued my physics studies on my own. I studied everything about Tesla. I read all of his patents, every book I could get on Tesla. And Magwitch, when I met him in the early 90s, it was because I had gotten Southern California Edison's president, John Bryson, at the time, to be interested in funding his non-radioactive nuclear fusion project. And Bryson sent one of their senior research scientists, Glenn Duckett, to meet with Magwitch and myself and Magwitch's peers. And among Magwitch were Murray Gell-Mann, who's one of the greatest legendary physicists of our time, Norman Rostocker, another incredible legend, and Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission under three presidents, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, was there. There were so many brilliant people in the room, and Glenn Duckett was like, you have no idea what this is like for me. I mean, he's a physicist, he's got his PhD, but he said, you have no idea who these people are. This is heaven to be in the room with these guys. And I thought it was going to be a slam dunk that Southern California Edison would finance Magwitch's Migma 5, you know, the next model in his helium-3 fusion testing. And it all just stopped. We were blocked at the highest levels of the U.S. government. And corporations were told not to fund Magwitch because due to an Air Force study at Kirtland Air Force Base by Major General D. Lamberson, the study on SuperCray 2 computers proved that Magwitch's next model was going to achieve fusion. In a miniature cubic meter device, we would have 1 billion watts of continuous non-radioactive nuclear energy. And nobody wanted it in the government, but NASA was all over it. So NASA had the, his name was Earl Van Landingham, who was a physicist and a rocket propulsion and advanced propulsion scientist, who was head of all space access and technology at NASA. He was on the phone with me for hours at a time, actually. And Earl said that they were so tired of the space station running on solar panels because there was so little power in those panels. They wanted Magwitch's Migma reactors up there because they'd have 1 billion watts in a cubic meter. So Earl, you know, taught me a lot about the applications of fusion, that it wasn't just for power. It was for propulsion that could do a tenth the speed of light, which is 67 million miles an hour. And which is unimaginable because 67 million miles an hour is actually faster than the top speeds the Navy radar data suggest that these UAP UFOs are going, which is approaching 80,000 miles an hour. So our fastest jets are, they barely ever reach even 2,000 miles an hour. They're mostly peaking at 1,500 miles an hour. Those are the fastest jets in the world. I mean, high altitude jets like the Lockheed SR-71, you know, can do, you know, still the fastest plane ever built, by the way, on Earth is the Lockheed SR-71.
Publicly disclosed.
But the point is, what Earl was telling me is the 18 MeV protons, 18 million electron volt charge protons coming out of the back of Magwitch's reactor. You could open a lens out of the back of the reactor, and these charged protons would fly out. And a proton has a lot of propellant mass, whereas an electron doesn't, right? So when you think of ion propulsion, an ion is an atom with a net negative or positive charge on it, right? But and they can get quite powerful. So Earl said that those highly charged particles could send spacecraft, you know, with slow acceleration up to a tenth the speed of light. And that would be beyond anything we can possibly imagine. And then you'd have to figure out, you know, braking in the opposite direction would be anti-thrust. So I was able to talk to Magwitch about it. I said, do you know that this is what Earl told me in our meetings at NASA? And Magwitch agreed that it would be extremely slow acceleration. But he said if you wanted sudden acceleration, you would have to use heavier element fusion. And then you have to get up into fusing much heavier elements. You know, like he suggested radioactive elements, actually. Like a uranium ion thrust fusion, he said, would be super fast acceleration. But the problem with super fast acceleration is the thrust wave behind the craft becomes destructive to anything in its path. And we don't see this evidence in the current Navy data of the UAP-UFO phenomena. We see accelerations that are sudden and stops that are sudden, and there's no evidence of massive thrust waves, which would destroy everything in their path at those speeds. So I've actually, you know, spent many years, you know, at least 10 years with Boyd Bushman, who was a Lockheed Martin senior research scientist. And Boyd was teaching me all of his concepts in gravitics, anti-gravitics, and propulsion were in relationship to advanced magnetism concepts. And the data I see in the UAP footage, and I go frame by frame by frame, Will, in the footage, I'm not seeing any thrusts. I don't believe we're looking at anti-gravity. I think we're looking at a very advanced form of magnetism that nobody on Earth has figured out. But I'm starting to figure it out. And I've been able to share my ideas because I suddenly got emails from Lockheed Martin in the last year. And they're, due to the UAP reports, they're talking to a lot of people in ufology. And I've given them some incredibly advanced ideas, you know, that I've, you know, pulled out of the data from looking at the footage of the UAPs. And it's clearly magnetic. And so there's a point in physics where, like, in what I do in my business at davidsrita.co, is I make coils, and I've been making these coils for years and years and years. First, very small coils that fit in a flashlight tube for therapeutic, you know, processes. And we've been able to turn people around with a great number of very serious illnesses and even sports injuries. We've been able to regrow nerves. We've been able to turn people around with cancer and Lyme disease. And yet, the way science works, I can't make a legal claim that you can treat any of those illnesses, but you can tell people, if you want to try this, you're welcome to try it. But then I started making my vortex coils, and I started making them with mathematical proportions, because what Tesla did is he basically made a cylindrical coil that changed the world. Like, if you go to your Bible, Book of Numbers, you'll see where really the birth of radio waves starts is with Moses, because God tells Moses to put of fiery, which to me means energetic serpent made of copper and tin, which is brass, on a pole. And that would be how Moses would communicate with God. And I thought it's really interesting how simple that is and how few people really understand what the staff of Moses really is, which again, I make them, you know, my team makes them with me, and we have them on the site, and the staff is a mini radio transmitter. In fact, when Tesla demonstrated radio with the Chicago World's Fair in 1893, he did exactly the same thing. When you spin copper on a pole and you pulse it with current and voltage, you're generating radio waves. So Tesla would have been the first one in modern history to generate radio waves. And radio waves travel right out into space at the speed of light. So when you look at Moses, and there I was in Berkeley, California, you know, this is the same time that I saw the UFO, and I'm building my first little radio as a kid, you know, 7 years old, and I'm wrapping my copper wire on a toilet paper roll, and I got my little diode and my little earbud, you know, headphones that I stick in my ear, and then you have your tuning rod, and you're sliding it up and down the coil, and you're changing stations, and you're listening to the radio. The simplest radio in the world is just a little crystal diode radio. Well, it happens to work very similar to the way Tesla built, you know, the first radio. And then Sir Oliver Lodge and Stone shared the invention of radio with Tesla, because they developed the more refined tuning aspects of it. And then eventually it goes to, you know, Marconi broadcast across the Atlantic using Tesla's patents, and apparently had access to them as a lab assistant, which is hard to confirm that exact fact. But it really looks like what Tesla starts is what the God of Moses started. It's just that people, when they read those ancient manuscripts, they're not realizing that what they're reading about is actually a piece of technology. Right. And then that staff becomes legend. The staff actually predates Moses. It goes way before Moses, because it starts with Adam and Eve in the forgotten books of Eden. Adam and Eve are given the first staff by God, and then every prophet thereafter, coming all the way up to Moses, has had their staff. And then if you read Jesus, Mark 6:8, Jesus insists that the 12 apostles must have their staffs with them at all times, once dispersed, to go out and preach the gospels. And so I started researching and finding out what is the meaning of the God of Moses wanting, and Jesus wanting, to be able to telecommunicate using this coiled staff, right? Which, again, is very detailed in the book of Numbers. And then the Bible tells us that the staff of Aaron lay in the Ark of the Covenant. And we know the Ark of the Covenant's measurement is 2.5 cubits, but there's cubit wars, and you've got to find the right cubit. Otherwise, you won't have the correct frequency, because I equated this staff at 2.5 cubits to be a monopole antenna, transmitter, receiver. And the height of a monopole is 1/4 of its wavelength that it transmits at. And all you do is take the speed of light, for example, in inches, divided by your wavelength in inches, and you have the frequency that monopole would operate at. So I spent actually years doing the math to find the right cubit. And if you look in Ezekiel, you'll see that God uses the cubit plus the hand. And that means a royal cubit. Without using the word royal cubit, the Bible continues to call it a cubit, but it's not a cubit. It's a cubit plus a hand. That's a royal cubit.
How many inches is a royal cubit?
Well, see, even how many inches is a royal cubit is slight. There are slight variances, and that's because actually at the time of Christ and at the time of Moses, there really was only, you know, the cubit and the royal cubit. But the problem is the Egyptian rods of measurement, rulers, I would call them, varied between 20.6 and 20.8 inches. And that's a discrepancy that is quite serious when you're measuring huge forms. So I had to do the math a different way because I couldn't accept between 20.6 and 20.8. And so then you have to resolve it perfectly. And so the way to resolve it perfectly is I took the Great Pyramid decoded by Peter Lemazurier. He found in over 20 places in the Great Pyramid, two royal cubits using lasers came to 20.605 inches per royal cubit. But then when I took 20.605 inches, it didn't resolve the height of the Great Pyramid to absolute perfection. And either the resolved height of the Great Pyramid at 480.69 feet, or was it 480.68 or 69 feet, was, I don't have the number right in front of me, but didn't resolve. And it had to resolve perfectly to 280 cubits, its finished height. And 20.601 inches per cubit did. So with 20.601, I go back to the Egyptian measuring rods, and one of the rods was 20.6 inches. And you wouldn't see the 01 because that's the one is in the thousandths of an inch column. And nobody today doing construction does anything to the thousandths of an inch column. So, in fact, a lot of scholars can't accept that kind of accuracy because only a laser could give you that kind of accuracy, right? To repeat. And that would tell me that the discrepancy in the rods, the Egyptian measuring rods, was that they themselves didn't know what a royal cubit was because they were trying to figure it out. So if you take using, now today's inch is 0.100106 difference than the ancient Egyptian inch. So the British royal inch is so close that on measuring small stuff, you won't detect a difference. But when you measure the height of the Great Pyramid, you will. Now, guess what happens? So if you use 20.601 inches times 280 cubits, your height of your Great Pyramid is exactly as Peter Lemazurier, in one of the greatest mathematicians of our time, who decoded the Great Pyramid, 480.69 feet. And that is perfect. Perfect. So if you go to what's called the Temple Scroll was proven very similar to the Shroud of Turin to have been printed by some type of 3D super advanced technology printing system. And so the Temple Scroll was not like other scrolls in the Dead Sea scrolls in that it had this different mechanism for having printed it. It wasn't written down by hand ink. It was printed. And so the Temple Scroll reveals that God wants Moses to build a 280 cubit Holy of Holies courtyard with two other cubit measurements for three courtyards around the Holy of Holies. Well, 280 cubits is the height of the Great Pyramid of Egypt using the 20.601 cubit inches per cubit. And that would tie the God of Moses to the Great Pyramid. Absolutely. So knowing that, and I discovered that myself, I looked at the measurement of the King's Chamber, which is 10 by 20 cubits, and the Queen's Chamber is 10 by 10 cubits with a higher ceiling for the purpose of a Holy of Holies fabric tent. So that when Moses had the first Ark of the Covenant, it was set up in a cubic tent, 10 by 10 by 10 cubits. And we know that God uses the royal cubit because it's perfected in the book of Ezekiel, in the visions of Ezekiel. So therefore, The Tabernacle of Moses then has what's called the Holy Place, which is 10 by 20 cubits, that precedes entering the Holy of Holies, right? Well, that would mean the King and Queen's chambers are perfect measurements of the Holy of Holies in the Holy Place. So again, the math would prove underlying language that the Great Pyramid of Egypt belongs to the God of the prophets, not to the Egyptians. And when Napoleon's armies blew up the side of the pyramid and got their way in, there were no hieroglyphs. There was nothing Egyptian in there at all. In fact, there was nothing. And nothing interests me because the God of the prophets tells the prophets that they can't have any images of God or any images of angels or anything in their practice in worshiping God. But the God of the prophets doesn't tell them they can't have a temple because, of course, the Holy of Holies is a temple, and actually the Ark of the Covenant is a mini temple, and the Holy Place is a temple. So that would mean a pyramid with no inscriptions in it would have the signature of the God of the prophets, and that, you know, again is a mathematical discovery that I made, as well as the temple scroll, that means the Great Pyramid of Egypt is not the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It's probably the temple to the Lord God in the book of Isaiah 19:19. If you read Isaiah 19:19, you'll see that there's a pillar to the Lord God and a temple to the Lord God in the land of Egypt. And at the border thereof, there's a pillar. And the pillar is the obelisk, is clearly the obelisk. And so I started studying obelisks because obelisks equated to staffs. And when I got my final measurement for the staff of Moses, which would then become the staff of Jesus and the apostles, Jesus's father in the infancy gospels has his staff, and a dove lands on his staff repeatedly to announce that he's going to be the father of the child that the mother Mary is carrying. And he's much older, but still he has his staff. So the staff is legend, and its height has to be perfect. And so therefore, because if its height is perfect, its frequency is perfect.
And what is that height?
Well, the height is 2.5 cubits, and the royal cubit is 20.605 inches if you're measuring smaller stuff. But when you measure bigger stuff, it's 20.601. So it comes to 51.5125 inches or 51.525 inches, depending on which of those cubits you use. And this is extremely hard to do, to get perfect. Right. So therefore, everything is measured against that, right? So my coils are based on the 14, and the 14 is based on the pyramid measurement. It's and the 34, like the Holy of Holies radius is 17.17 feet times 2, which is 34.34 feet in diameter. And then it gets more amazing because I take my family to Chaco Canyon in New Mexico. I used to live in New Mexico, and my dad lives there. And I get a Leica laser, and I'm measuring the diameter of the circles in Chaco Canyon, which is a preeminent, you know, Native American civilization that was abandoned and probably has a deep connection to the pyramids of Mesoamerica, Central America, Mexico.
Aligned astronomically at great distances, correct?
Right. And so Chaco Canyon, I measured on a Leica laser a perfect Holy of Holies. Perfect. And I told the park ranger, I said, you know, I got the book, and the book says that these are approximate measurements. So I came in here with a laser, and I said, did you guys ever use a laser? Because you have a circle in there that is a perfect Holy of Holies on a Leica laser. And they just looked at me. They couldn't even speak, because it was embarrassing, really, that they didn't give these people credit for being master builders and having measured things perfectly. So I measured their other circles, and the bigger circles corresponded to the Great Pyramid perfectly. So how would that occur, that knowledge would transmigrate? Well, if you study language and you understand accents and original creative sound vibrations, the word for Mexico City is Tenochtitlan, but the T is an accent that is evident in their culture in a lot of their words. So if you take off the T, you have Enoch Land, and Enoch is the first biblical prophet. He's the first prophet after Adam and Eve, right? He's the first prophet. So Enoch was taken in the book of Enoch in what appears to be a crystal ship with God and the angels, Michael and Gabriel, and probably was taken to the region of Mesoamerica we're talking about. And those measurements were transferred. And that's why we see those measurements in Chaco Canyon, because all they needed was a perfectly measured piece of string made out of jute and a pole. And then you carve your circle in the dirt and you build your stone circle, you know, with that radius. And so Holy of Holies radius is 17.17 feet. And then your circumference, you know, is times pi. And so that's what I saw there in Chaco Canyon. So nobody has gone into Chichen Itza, El Castillo and the castle and measured it perfectly with lasers. The Mexican government hasn't done that, whereas the Great Pyramid has. But I've been trying to do that work and get precise measurements. I've been down there, but it was pouring rain at the time, like a monsoon, and there's no way I could do any work. But it's really important, because when you look at math as an underlying language, and then you look at word and how a word like Tenochtitlan becomes Enoch Land, if you take off the T, and then you see a connection. And as we're speaking, a hawk has come in and he's doing circles around my yard right now as we're talking about. I've never seen this happen. This hawk is just doing circles, really tight circles. He's right above me. You should really see this. But anyway, so what I do when all of my coils, my staffs, everything is measured. And the next thing that really proved that the ancient Hebrews and all of the prophets used this cubit measurement we're talking about, and that the Hebrew short cubit and long cubit were off by a tad, is when Wyatt's crew, I'm trying to remember, it was James or Ron Wyatt's crew found.
It was Ron.
Ron found the remains of the Ark, Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat. It came
with
to
David with David Faisal.
Okay, it came to 515 feet. Now watch, take 515 feet. Now they're using a tape; they don't have a laser. Times 12 inches per foot. 6180 divided by 20.601 inches per cubit, it's 300 cubits. So, but they didn't use a tape, so that they wouldn't see the small increment after the fraction of an inch. But that's proof that Noah used the 20.601 or 20.605 inch cubit. We don't know which one he used, but they're so tiny. The difference is so tiny between 20.605 and 20.601. It's so small. But clearly, we have evidence now that we have the royal cubit of the ancient world. In fact, that measurement was so long for the researchers, they couldn't accept that it was Noah's Ark because they were attached to the wrong cubit. But there was no other cubit. At the time of Moses and the earlier prophets, there was no other cubit. The Jews wanted to establish a unique cubit because they didn't want to be likened to the Egyptians at all. So they separated themselves by refining their own cubit. So I think the Hebrew long is the Hebrew long cubit, I'll tell you in a second here, is this is important. It's all important because when you're looking to decode how big the Ark of the Covenant will be, all of it matters so much. Hebrew.
And if you don't mind me asking here in the pause, the Ark of the Covenant, should it be made of acacia wood? Does it matter? Are there better materials?
Well, you got to look at what the Bible is saying. I mean, what did Wyatt's crew say it was made out of?
I actually don't recall.
I'll have to look at that. I have that article, actually. So the Hebrew long is 20.4 inches per, which would make a Holy of Holies exactly 34 feet, by the way.
So, and the reason I ask about the Ark of the Covenant is in biodynamic agriculture, there's when you're finished making your preparations, it's common to store them in a box. And I'm thinking the configuration measurements for the Ark of the Covenant might be a good box to store one's preps in.
Right. No, acacia wood is beautiful stuff. It's definitely beautiful stuff. So I'm just trying to find my article and my... I've got so many bookmarks. I'm just trying to see if there's... See, here we go. And this is important to demonstrate. This particular Egyptian obelisk that was found they said... I'm looking at an unfinished obelisk laying in the ground. And they said it would have been about 120 feet tall, right? So do you know what's interesting about that? Okay, the height of the Great Pyramid is 480.69 feet. So if an obelisk is a monofold transmitter, 120 feet times 4 would be the wavelength is 480 feet. And this says about 120 feet. And the Great Pyramid is 480.69 feet. So you just have to divide 0.69 feet by 4 and realize this particular unfinished obelisk was transmitting a wavelength equal to the height of the Great Pyramid of Egypt. And you start to see that they knew this way back then. They knew the obelisks were transmitters. So well, I took the Washington Monument's final measurement, and I calculated something that just blew my mind. I wasn't even expecting this to happen. I didn't think the builders of the Washington Monument were going to realize that they were in absolute perfection to the Great Pyramid. So if you take the Washington Monument and you take its exact height,
I believe we're getting some signal interruptions from
trying to find.
There we are.
Those images that I have here. And you draw two circles. You draw two circles based on the height of the monument. And the Vesica Pisces intersecting height is the exact height of the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Exactly. And that is so mind-blowing that there's a hidden dimension to the Great Pyramid that it is the leftover height of the Vesica Pisces, which is two circles intersecting midsection to form the Vesica Pisces, the Great Pyramid of Egypt has a higher dimension in the math, and the Washington Monument is it. And when you calculate, you take the height of the monument times 4 as its wavelength, and the speed of light divided by that, and you look at the frequency. I don't have the numbers right in front of me because I've moved my files somewhere. I don't know where they are, but what I did is I calculated the radio frequency coming off the monument's exact finish height, and it's exact. And because it's the speed of light divided by the wavelength, and the wavelength is 4 times the height. And I divide it by a musical octave, I come to the frequency 432 hertz. And everybody knows the conspiracy theory that the French and the early Europeans tuned their classical music instruments to 432 instead of A at 440. Mm-hmm. And I said, how perfect is this that, you know, an obelisk, the height of the two circles that form a Vesca Pisces that give birth to the Great Pyramid of Egypt would be a 432 harmonic scale instrument, right? And guess what happens thereafter? As the monument is coming to completion, as it's coming to completion, every major invention that changed the history of the world is suddenly born. And I've got this documented in a graphic that is stunning. Like, at its, the monument is coming to its completion between 1848 and 1884. 1877, Edison invents the phonograph and the light bulb. 1879, Tesla invents HC. 1882. And you have to understand, Tesla and Edison's labs were in New Jersey within this magic radius of the monument. Suddenly the world changes. Edison invents direct current 1882 and the Battle of the Currents. Tesla invents radio 1893. Remember, the monument was completed in 1884. And Lodge invents EMF 1894. Tesla remote control 1898. And you have Bell invents the telephone 1877. So that's just as the monument is in its last phases.
David, I have to ask, is this knowledge still kept in occult circles?
No, I discovered this, and it.
How would they know the height to build it?
Oh, you're talking about how would they know the height to build it? Well, that's what. Then you research the architects. Wills is one of the architects. I mean, there's a page on the U.S. Park Service, and you'll see when you look at the Washington Monument from above, you'll see the two Vesca Pisces circles in the grass intersecting right where the monument is. So somebody knows, Will, because the symbol of the Vesca Pisces in the grass, right where the monument is coming out of the center of the Vesca Pisces, is a clue. And the clue has been sitting there for as long as they've had that feature in the grass. So somebody knows what I figured out, right?
Right.
Farnsworth invents TV, 1922. Zorikin, Vladimir Zorikin, the cathode ray 2, 1917. As soon as that monument goes up, everything happens. The Wright brothers, 1903. Carl Jansky invents at Bell Labs radio astronomy. And Breton, Shockley, and Bardeen invent the transistor in 1947, right there at Bell Labs, New Jersey. You have to understand, the monument's transmitting a wave four times its height, but it goes out at the speed of light, and it's powered because it's a steel structured core, so it's conductive with a semiconductive marble casing stones. And literally, if you look at the slope angle of the pyramidion on the top, and then go to your dollar, to the great seal on the back of your U.S. dollar, they both have the same slope angle, not pyramid angle. It's not the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which is 51 degrees, 51 minutes, and 14.3 seconds. You see, this, what's on the back of your dollar, is the slope angle of the pyramidion. And the slope angle of the pyramidion, I'm pretty sure, I just got to find my graphic here, because it's let's see, what did I call these? You know what I'll do? I'll just go to my website, because I have, if you go to my website, to davidcerita.co, and you go to the Washington Monument section, you're going to see all the graphics about that I figured out. Let's see, where is the monument? It might be under 432 now, because...
Oh, no. Have you done the calculation for what the intersection at the bottom of the Pisces would be? And would that be relevant?
Oh, I've calculated both of them. Yeah, exactly. And I sell those frequencies, by the way. They're on my site. So if you go to the Washington Monument, so it's davidcerita.co/Washington. And you'll see, if you scroll down, there's a picture of the U.S. dollar. And then... the U.S. dollar and the pyramidion are 70 degree slope angles, 70 degrees. So the idea that the pyramid on the back of the Dara was the Egyptian pyramid is incorrect. It's the slope angle of the obelisk of Washington, D.C., which is a 70-degree slope angle. And what its height by its width is in proportion to Solomon's temple. And that math, there's a whole presentation. If you go to that page on my website, davidsarita.co/Washington, there's actually an audio presentation. There's a video presentation where I really take people through this. And I believe the math proves, like, you know, people have all kinds of theories about the monument. The math proves it, that it's a 432 octave tuner, because the octaves coming off of it go all the way down to 432 and not a 440 as musically as incorrect we use today, was a frequency of enlightenment. And that frequency, I believed, opened up a creative portal. Because why did all these inventions happen in America first? Well, why did the transistor happen in America first? Why did all of them happen in America first? And then the rest of the world started getting access to the patents and spinning off theories and ideas based on these inventions. And the airplane, the automobile, Henry Ford, it all happens within this magic radius of the monument. And then once the knowledge spreads, then there's a lot of fine-tuning and more perfection of those core inventions. But it didn't happen in Italy. It didn't happen in France. It happened there. Bell Labs is key. And Tesla and Edison's labs were key. And Henry Ford's, you know, automobile was key. Even though and Tesla is, again, you know, he's right there. And the monument is coming into completion. And he doesn't have his inventions in the former Yugoslavia. He has his inventions in New Jersey, in this region. And then he does experiments at Colorado Springs, at Pikes Peak, and then Long Island, New York. And as you get further and further from the monument, the frequency is still there. It just gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And when it gets struck by lightning, everybody gets supercharged by the blast wave that comes off of it. And the monument did, you know, there's a great video of it. I think I have it there on my site where the monument got struck by lightning last year, actually. So frequency is the gateway to opening creativity and consciousness. It can cause an epiphany in the human mind that can transform an entire civilization. So why, again, go to the book of Isaiah 19:19? Did God have all of these temples and the pillars measured perfectly? Like the pillar and the temple to the Lord and the pillar in Isaiah, this is an obelisk. And the pillar is an obelisk. And the temple was probably the Great Pyramid, most likely, because that's what the math tells us. Because the math is the language. The God of the Bible is giving the prophets precise measurements and how to build stuff in these precise measurements. So why does it matter so much? Because structure is wavelength, and gives off wavelength. And wavelength and a frequency are exactly the same thing. There's no difference. It's just a calculation to tell you how many waves will oscillate in a second. But a second is arbitrary. But the wavelength itself is what matters. So
I'd like to talk about some of these applications real quick. You know, I've worked with you or you know, been working with you and your coils for about 6 or 7 years now. And let's see, a few years ago, I took one of your smaller, I guess you're calling them mini coils today, and was doing some germination research at a cannabis facility in Arizona, and put the sun frequency on a germination tray. And they were all feminized seeds, yet over 70% of them germinated male. I wondered if you'd heard anything like that, had any thoughts on that?
Oh, no, that's interesting. I mean, I did have a cannabis grower use the sound of the sun with my bigger coils, and he got the biggest and the most prolific buds he'd ever seen in his life. And he swears
post-germination. Yeah.
Yeah, well, post-germination, yeah. But he also did it in the germinating stage. And
interesting.
And there's, you know, maybe I would try switching the direction of the flow of current. You could switch, you know, your positive and negative wires, switch them and see what happens. That would be interesting. And then,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, along this greater agricultural theme, what other potential applications can you imagine in even potentially on a farm scale?
Well, we had a guy in California who was dealing with serious blight in the tomato greenhouses, and his whole region was struck by blight, and he did the sound of the sun on the water supply as it was going in, and the blight, it was gone.
No, I've definitely done that and had great success with that.
Oh,
and
you've done that and had success with it.
Yes, I did a large vortexing, 300-gallon vortex tank, and had that's when I got your three-story magnetic coil on the plexiglass sheet with the hole in the center, so that the center of the vortexing water would actually pass through it. But when you're mentioning all these angled degrees, I also put a Vogel crystal in the center where the water vortex would collapse. And it's also 51 degrees, 51 minutes, but I believe it ends up being 51 seconds instead of 25 or 14 seconds. And wondered if you have, you know, if you're familiar with Vogel's work and what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I don't think the seconds, I mean, the seconds are arguable, definitely.
No. What do you think about quartz? Generally,
well, quartz in combination, when you have a magnetic field, and again, my coils are different than Tesla's in that Tesla did cylinders, and I'm doing 14 points for a reason. The 14 corresponds to the Great Pyramid, and the I'll show you here. I'll just take the hang on a second. My mouse moves around a bit. See, take 14 times the Holy of Holies is the height of the Great Pyramid. So the Great Pyramid, 480.6 feet, 480.69 divided by the Holy of Holies diameter is 14. It's so the 14 is proportional. So I look at ratio as well. Like now I do 7-level coils, and I also do 8-level coils. And I have a new project coming out that's called the Cube, which is the speed of light squared and cubed. And you have to see how that actually occurs. And this the Cube is coming out very soon. I've got my first one sitting right here next to me. And I haven't plugged it in yet because I'm doing my connections. And when these come out, it's going to outperform my regular coils by a factor of at least 100. But
wow,
yeah, they can treat more water, a larger area for biodynamics. And there's many different frequencies I've tested on plants. I mean, you can definitely see when you treat just your seeds versus not treating seeds, higher germination rates. We were able to ward off pests. Like I took a mint plant that was infested with aphids, and I treated it with just one of my wands, actually, and the aphids all died, and the mint leaves got bigger. They were more voluminous than they previously were.
And did you say what frequency you were using with the wand?
I was just using the sound of the sun.
Right.
In those days. But now I've got so many different experiences I'm having. Like, I can take star frequencies, which are all my star frequencies are legendary star systems based on the radius of that star. And if I treat my alfalfa sprouts with those frequencies, I had an incredible spiritual experience. Like I did Palladian frequencies on my sprouts. In fact, I didn't use any sunlight. They greened up just in the presence of the coils because it's electromagnetism, right? So they actually turn the chlorophyll function activates even without sunlight as long as you have coils emitting electromagnetism. I ate the sprouts and I was meditating and I opened my eyes and I could see the Pleiades holographically hovering right in front of me with my eyes open, not a vision with my eyes closed. And I was blinking my eyes saying, I can't believe I'm seeing this, but I'm really seeing this, that the Pleiades are hovering right in front of me like a hologram. and from eating the alfalfa sprout. So plants can be encoded with frequencies, and therefore so could marijuana. So I could take, I could take Sirius or Pleiades or Vega. I mean, I have so many stars that I've, based on the radius, decoded the wavelengths and a musical scale for almost any star you can think of. And you can, it aligns you to that star system when you eat those sprouts or you eat that food. And again, when I did my test, I didn't use sunlight on my sprouts. I kept them in the dark, only exposing them to the coil several times
a day. Interesting.
So it was very dense. So there was no dilution, even though our sunlight goes right through walls. I mean, the electromagnetic part of our sun, the radiant heat goes right through solid walls. There is an influence there.
But if you were to do it in like a lead box.
Yeah, imagine selling, like even at the germination stage, which is all I believe you have to do, is you can treat marijuana with different star systems or even Great Pyramid frequencies. And when they partake of that plant, they're going to have an experience that's vibrationally unique, very unique.
Now, something that's been on my mind for some time since I got into biodynamics is this idea of being able to germinate plants in something of the equivalent of the Christ nativity moment.
We've done that. So what I've done is I've taken the ratio of location, the ratio of location on GPS coordinates, and I had one of the most profound spiritual experiences of my life last winter doing the coordinates for the baptism site of Christ and John the Baptist. I got to experience what it was like to be baptized. And I cannot tell you the difference, because when I was baptized as a kid, I remember it so perfectly. There was no spiritual experience at all. And when I did these frequencies, which we did, it's hard to find the location of the nativity. There is the church of the nativity, and we have those frequencies. And I've also got the location of the tomb of Christ, and I've done those frequencies. And when I tested the frequencies of the Sphinx, I had this vision of going down stairs underground. I'm like, what are these stairs going underground? And I had to Google, and I found the Osiris shaft was very nearby, and it had these stairs going way, way down, way, way down. And they found these huge sarcophaguses down there. And I said, I must have been remote viewing the Osiris shaft when I did those coordinates as frequencies, right? Because ratio transcends frequency. It transcends it, because frequency is a measurement in time. It's proportional to time, but ratio is proprietary. So when I looked at longitude, latitudes, I thought, well, those numbers don't mean anything, but their proportion does mean something energetically. And it does take you to the place. But it takes you to the energy of the place rather than the physical place. So the experience I had, and I repeated the experience at least three times on the location of Christ's baptism. And the experience was, I did the frequencies and through one of my coil bed systems, and all of a sudden I'm there, I'm in the river, and I literally see John the Baptist. I can see what he looks like. And it's like I'm in the point of view of Christ, and I'm going under the water, and all of a sudden my aura and my energy field expands infinitely out into space, and it's so peaceful and so cosmic. But then the wave came back in to the body, and the moment I came back into embodiment, there was a level of bliss and supreme ecstasy that was so far beyond my ordinary meditation state. And my ordinary meditation state, now I reach supreme bliss every day, but this was a hundredfold. And it lasted for hours. I was walking around the yard. I'm like, this can't be my imagination, because this isn't going away. And it's way brighter than the bliss that I already feel every day. And I said, I'm going to do this again. And I did it again, and I duplicated it again, and then I did it three times, and I said, oh my God, that's enough. This is really showing me, because the place where Christ was baptized, first of all, John the Baptist baptizes Jesus, and he doesn't become a follower of Jesus. He continues to baptize people on his own, and thousands of people were coming to that spot. And that spot is the place where the prophet Elijah ascended into the sky, right? So it's a very sacred location. And Jesus calls John the Baptist Elijah reincarnated, basically. And so it's very interesting. A lot of Christians don't understand why didn't John the Baptist follow Jesus. And that's because John the Baptist was already plugged in to the Holy Spirit.
Right.
He was doing the same thing. And of course, Elijah had his staff. It's very, very important to understand that Elijah had his staff. And Elijah's assistant or disciple, Elisha, actually raises a person from the dead with his staff. And that Jesus, when he raised Lazarus, clearly would have had his staff. Because the staff is mentioned in John 6:8 as a must. You must have your staff. Which is a frequency calibrator, you know, and they would have been measured perfectly. They weren't pieces of wood. They were not pieces of wood. There's no way it was a piece of wood. So that's, you know, the power of the ability to move your energy field holographically to a place, a holy place, is there.
And then is time relevant?
Well, all time exists at the same time. It all exists. And it's there. It's in the record for that location. So it only took a little bit of effort on my mind. I just relaxed on the table and did the frequencies. It was very easy to see, you know, John the Baptist with his wild beard and his, you know, his clothing is all, you know, hand spun. And it was so easy to see him. He was shorter than Jesus. And it's just so easy to see it. It was effortless. I didn't have to try to imagine anything. But more important, what it looked like is what it felt like. And I realized if John the Baptist could do this to every person who got baptized, and so could Jesus, they would all want to get baptized because they would experience the most incredible state of perfection and bliss and ecstasy humanly possible. And that is the... that is what it means to have your sins forgiven or cleansed from you so that you go back to the original state of perfection in the Garden of Eden before the knowledge of good and evil was taken. So that's how powerful this stuff gets. And when, like, the frequencies of the Washington Monument, I believe, transformed a civilization, took it from the Dark Ages into an age of high technology overnight.
New Atlantis.
And like Atlantis, it happened overnight. I mean, when I look at my Washington Monument graph and I see, okay, what were the inventions that existed before this time? You know, Benjamin Franklin saw lightning striking, you know, a key on his kite. We all learned this in school in San Francisco when I was a kid. But all these inventions just are suddenly born the moment the monument is erected. They didn't exist before it, and they keep happening. Bell Labs is a major place, you know, major, major place. And the cell phone, all of it, it just keeps happening, and it keeps happening, and it keeps happening. And so that monument is a great power. Yes, somebody could distort its frequency by hijacking its frame and transmitting the wrong frequency through it. But if it's left alone and it's powered by the Schumann energies, then it's giving off the wavelength that is proportional to a massive creative inciting. And that's what gave America the leading edge in the entire world for a long time. Is, I believe, that monument changed everything.
So when you're talking about the, you know, Washington Monument and magnetism, I'm reminded of Phil Callahan's work on paramagnetism and the round towers and their influence on agriculture and plant growth. Are you familiar with his work at all?
No, but I'm familiar with paramagnetism.
Are you familiar with paramagnetism and its impact on biological systems?
No.
Okay. Well, Dr. Callahan proposed that it increased plant growth and otherwise animal growth. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, whether or not it's basalt mineral or oxygen, but interesting subject for anyone out there who's interested.
Are you familiar with frequency has a benefit to plant growth, but you have to use correct frequencies. Like these microwave towers that are transmitting could easily switch their frequency bands to Fibonacci, high Fibonacci numbers, but they won't do it. They're just transmitting any old frequency they want, and they're causing a lot of destruction. And even the current massive heat wave that we experienced up here in the Northwest is unprecedented and could easily be attributed to the increase in microwave activity. I mean, right now, most of the blame goes to global warming, but I would put a lot of the blame on the microwave towers distorting the weather and temperature background.
Do you think it's ignorant or malevolent?
What?
The chosen frequencies.
Oh, they're malevolent.
Yeah, okay.
I know that for a fact. I had somebody from one of those companies get on the phone with me. He wanted to buy one of my wands, and he said they're transmitting frequencies and running the internet in frequencies they know that cause cancer, and they know it.
Right.
That's why you have to have your own personal transmitter in your own space to recalibrate your own space on a constant basis, so to kind of give you a little bubble of harmony against the background of the disharmony.
So I did a little bit of, watched some of your interviews and whatnot before the show. And one thing that's struck me is when you were speaking to the skeletal system and calcium as a, as a receiver. And again, I'm not sure if at all you are with biodynamics, but there are agricultural preparations that are made. And one of them involves the stuffing of a animal skull, typically a bovine, with oak bark. Just wondering if you'd speak to the idea of the skeletal system of potentially specifically the skull as a receiver.
Well, calcium is a metal. It's not a really good conductor, but if you look at its crystal lattice, it's six pyramids in a cube, which is the same as gold, actually. So in piezoelectricity, which is when you pulse a crystal lattice with pulses, which is what frequencies are, it radiates off, ohmic energy into an energy field. So that means that our temples, pyramids and cubes, the Holy of Holies was a cube, are the same structures as the calcium. And when a human body is consumed in flames, you're left with your sodium and your calcium. And so that's our crystal inner temple structure. So it's very interesting, this idea of stuffing, a cow's head with oak. And you put that in the soil, do you?
You do. You bury it for a year where, as he put it, where the water runs or where the snow melts.
Yeah, there you go.
So there's a lot of water involved.
And when you bury it, it's getting powered. It's getting pulsed by the Tesla-Schumann resonance. Anything you put in the ground is doing that. So it radiates, right, just like the Washington Monument, because it has a steel frame structure that's connected to the earth. It's going to radiate.
So and that leads to my next question. Oh, please go ahead.
Sodium's crystal lattice is body-centered cubic. Yeah, there you go. So it's the same. It's every single element on the periodic table. It has a different structure. So sodium is body-centered cubic. So that's your six pyramids in your cube, and that's really miraculous in a way. It's quite amazing. that's our structure. So when you say God created us in God's image, when you get down to the crystal lattice scale, we're cubes and pyramids. And that's not a coincidence that our temples are built in those structures. But again, the measurements have to be precise in these temples in order for them to vibrate at the correct frequencies.
And so two more of the primary preparations are involve this filling of bovine horns or hooves, but primarily horns, once with manure and the second one with crushed quartz crystal. And they're also buried in the earth. The one that's filled with manure is buried during the winter, and the one that's stuffed with quartz is buried during the summer. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the horn as a vessel, as a sleeve.
Well, the horn is a tuner.
Okay.
There's no doubt it has an antenna-like function. And the way it's shaped is, it will eventually carry itself into a Fibonacci spiral pattern if you continue the line of the structure. And so they're definitely, I've always seen antlers as horn, as an antenna, because bones are calcium and collagen and trace minerals, phosphorus even. Mm-hmm. And so they're very powerful. I mean, it's the core of our electrical circuit. The sodium in the blood and which is moving, and the iron in our blood, which is moving in a current, is going to generate a magnetic field.
And that's interesting. Another one of the preparations, there's only nine primary ones, but one of the next in order is a cervid. It is a stag. You take its bladder and you fill it with yarrow flowers and hang it in a tree during the summer. But yeah, he definitely relates the antlers to a type of antenna.
That's fascinating.
So like I said, we've been, I've worked with you, for the past 6 or 7 years on these, coils, worked with you a little bit and then, getting the frequencies and done some, other wise experiments. But I was listening to, Joe Rogan a couple of years ago, and he had Dan Aykroyd on, and all of a sudden he starts talking about David Sarita. And I didn't know you from that world at all. I was wondering if you might talk about your relationship and history with Dan Aykroyd.
Well, Dan introduced me, to a lot of very powerful people, but I met Dan through this woman in Canada who is now deceased, who thought he should meet me to look at my NASA UFO footage and see what he thought of it. And from that moment on, Dan and I became friends, and I made my first film was Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs, that was released in the year 2000 on VHS. And then Dan decided that he would give me a cameo interview for Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs. And I made that film, spent a lot of money on it, and lost all of it because it was stolen on the internet. Our DVDs, it was right at the point where the internet, everything could be hijacked and put for free. Movies could be put for free. Rip torrents could put movies for free. And so I made the film with Dan, and then we just stayed in touch over the years. And just of always, his mind is so advanced for somebody in that world. I don't think there's a single person in Hollywood who knows more than Dan Aykroyd about what's really going on. And Dan told Joe Rogan to have me on his show, but Joe never gave me that call. So somebody somewhere must have blocked me from getting that interview with Joe Rogan. But
I don't think
Joe Rogan is that open to on UFOs. I mean, he said that on the air. He's not really a believer. But I think when this Navy footage came out right after he was saying things like that, he kind of had to think otherwise because, now you have your pilots testifying.
Now, on that footage and on all this release, and it feels like a lot of this release of documentation feels like it's being pushed by the Pentagon. Is it your inclination that this is actually alien technology, or do you think it's reservation human technology?
No, I think the UFOs the Navy are chasing to try to find their identity are not ours. And that's because I have data that even most people in ufology haven't looked at or don't see that's right in the footage itself. And I look at the points of entry and exit. And for example, this was in the series Unidentified, and U.S. Navy Chief Sean Cahill, who was on the Princeton off the coast of Baja, said that according to the radar data from Kevin Day, the UFOs disappeared in this. There was a magnetic anomaly detected north of Guadalupe Island, just north of the island. And that's where they disappeared on radar. So that the north latitude of that location is identical to the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It's the same north latitude. And the Houston Control Center, where all the Apollo missions were controlled out of, is very close to that north latitude. It's only a tad off. And then also in the Space Shuttle Columbia incident, the moment we lost radio contact with the astronauts was the same north latitude, the Great Pyramid's north latitude. And that kind of data tells me there's no way this is ours, because we don't, if we have UFOs of our own flying around and we're in this cat and dog chase with the Navy, we wouldn't be disappearing in a sacred site, you know, coordinate like that. That's something otherworldly. And I know Stephen Greer's new film thinks it's all fake footage that the Navy has, and it's part of a big trick to get the whole world to militarize space and create a fake ET invasion. But
Project Blue Beam.
Yeah, there's no proof of that, that's what these things are. You know, there's no proof of that at all. The most frustrating thing in ufology is trying to understand why we can't intercept their radio communications, because we think they're using radio waves to communicate, and I definitely don't think they're using radio waves to communicate. Their radios work on a quantum function, and I was able to build such a radio system and make contact with Pleiades very effectively and repeatedly and reliably for the space of 2 years. And if you do something scientifically and you get one result, but you can't repeat it, then you would say that's random, that you might be close to developing a technology, but you're missing something if you can't repeat it. Just like I was able to repeat the experience of the baptism of Christ in the sight of John the Baptist 3 times. And with the method I use for contacting the Pleiades is a ratio harmonic space method. It's a magnetic radio, and it communicates in the quantum. It doesn't send radio waves outward. It sends them inwards. And I use ratio. Ratio is extremely powerful. And when I was getting the radius of every known star I could think of in the local universe, and I would only develop star frequencies based on stars that we had a very good ratio for, then if the ratio was, I mean, sorry, the radius, the very good radius for, if we didn't have a good radius, then I couldn't really do accurate calculations for that star. But one thing I found is no two stars had the same frequency, and therefore wavelength, and therefore radius. So that means every star, just like every radio station, is separated by its frequency, right? So every star is separated by its harmonics, its frequencies. And a sphere, the way radio waves propagate on a sphere and set up standing waves like the Tesla-Schumann resonances is proof to me that a sphere is not one stagnant frequency like you would like a radio station to be. So, and then when you look at the way stars arrange themselves in patterns, you have ratio, and those ratios are proprietary to that star group. And that's just a clue in how I did it. But what amazes me, you know, I did it. It was so successful. Actually, on my website, there's a recording of all my experiences I had when I was sending out the Pleiadian transmissions. And then I stopped doing it. And when I stopped doing it, I didn't have any more experiences. But the UFO, going back to the UFO I saw in 1968 in Berkeley, that was Palladian. They showed me the Palladian star system, but they don't call it Pleiades. They just showed me what it looks like in a hologram. And they said that's where they're from. And when I used to play hide and go seek and kick the can in the 1960s in San Francisco and Modesto, California, I would always look at them. I'd be counting to 100 in the summer, looking up and looking at them. And I didn't even know what they were called at that time, actually. I didn't even know they were called Pleiades as a kid. I would just look at them, you know, when they were up there. And that's late summer, right? When Pleiades starts coming up, August, September. I can't remember exactly what time they start showing up really late at night in the eastern horizon. But anyway, you know, why wouldn't more people be interested in how I did it? Well, I think what happens in the world today is there's so much entertainment on the internet. There's so many stories. But the idea that UFOs are in our skies and we can't intercept their communications should be very alarming. And the fact that we think that everything communicates the way we do, which is at the speed of light, which is incredibly slow, is disturbing, because we know there are quantum functions that communicate faster than the speed of light. So why wouldn't we be interested in that? And science is such that the people who control it want to be the ones who discovered it. And if it's somebody they don't like from a world they don't like me, they're not going to come to me and ask.
Right, they're not going to legitimize alternative technology. What do you think about Bob Lazar there, and you know, his becoming more mainstream, the Element 115, all that?
Well, Element 115, see, you got to understand, Bob Lazar was a very young guy when he was brought into S4 and Area 51. So I guess they were looking for new, fresh ideas on the data they had. His interpretation of 115 doesn't interest me. I don't think it had anything to do with propulsion, but I think it had another function, but it wasn't the anti-gravity. And I love, you know, Lazar knows me. He's been on my site. He's very aloof. He won't talk to me, but I could get, you know, again, he was brought in to look at the data. And obviously, if they were interested in his interpretation of the data, they would have kept him on. And the fact that they let him go means they weren't interested in his interpretation of the data. So that means that whatever he's saying isn't really that interesting. Because, again, if his interpretation of the data was interesting to them, they would have locked him up and he would have never left the facility.
Do you think he had access to actual alien craft and technology, or do you
think? Oh yeah, I think he saw it all. I know other people who have seen it too. Meaning, I met a man from England who built the first afterburners for Rolls Royce, and he was in there. He was a metallurgist, and they wanted him to get through the skin, the container, and there was no way to get through it. And once there was no way to get through it, that he knew how, so they let him go. Right. And again, you have to understand, everyone forgets this. They let Lazar go. That means he didn't know enough. Well, he was too young. He was very young. Like, I'm 60 next month. Okay, so how old is Lazar? What is his age? He's just a tad older than I am. So what's Bob Lazar? Age.
No, I think you're right. I think he was putting...
He's 52 years old. He's born in 59. I was born in 61. So I've been in those worlds. I've worked for Department of Defense through Magwitch. And it's all a buddy system. Right. So he was born January 26th. So this next January, he'll be 63. So he's 59, 60. He's 2 years ahead of me. I mean, this is nothing. So you have to understand how young was Bob Lazar when he worked. He was hired in the late 80s to reverse engineer technology. So you go, let's say he's
mid-20s.
1988 -1959, he would have been 29 years old. It's a young mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and good, and a good reason to bring in a young mind who doesn't have a PhD, who's got some engineering experience, electrical engineering experience, but obviously they wanted to bring people in to get interpretation on data.
So right? What do you think the best potential use of element 115 is?
Well, I don't think element 115 needs to be stable because its function is actually to open up a micro wormhole. Which is, and that wormhole only needs to open for a billionth of a second to do its job. So there's two functions in the craft. One is the anti-gravitics is not fighting gravity. It's actually magnetic. And I understand magnetic propulsion really on a very advanced level. And again, recently was contacted by Lockheed Martin about this stuff. So I'm not really going to talk about how that works, but they have all my information. Lockheed does.
Come on, tell us, David.
No, I can't tell you because I shared it with them, right? So, and I'm, you know, I'm very patriotic that way. Even though I was born in Canada, I was raised in America. So I'm very patriotic that way. So I'm not going to put it out on the internet. But the purpose of 115 is there. Because what it does is in a flash, it opens up a micro wormhole so they can leap to hyperspace. But it has nothing to do with propulsion at all. That's my interpretation of the data. Now, Lazar has his interpretation of the data. But again, if they were interested in his interpretation, why didn't they keep him? You don't keep people that you like their data and their understanding of physics. You get rid of people who you don't like what they're doing. So, again, I know many scientists who were brought in to S4 Area 51 saw the craft, and their interpretation of data wasn't good enough, and they let them go, and they never went back there. Why would they? If Lazar really understood how the craft worked, then he could build one, because the guy ran a company in New Mexico for years, and he still does, selling, you know, all radioactive elements, magnets, all kinds of science toys, right? And he hasn't been able to build anything that works, as far as we know. But I believe his story. I believe he went in there. But again, mm-hmm. I know other people have gone in there. And I would say, if you know somebody who's been in there, and they're not still in there, you wouldn't know them. And two, whatever their interpretation of the data was no good. And that's why they're not in there. And that's why you know them. So that means they're not very interesting. Boyd Bushman was interested in me for a long time at Lockheed. He's gone. And the new guys that are in there are in touch with me. And I hope they figure this out. And I'm not saying I have all the data and all the answers, but what I told them, this is extremely advanced magnetism, the way these things are moving. It has nothing to do with anti-gravity. Forget the idea of anti-gravity, because at a certain point, magnetism is stronger than gravity at a certain point. But you have to know that we're amateurs in magnetism, actually. We're total amateurs. And it's not just the property of the materials, it's something else. So you have your paramagnetism, diamagnetism, and ferromagnetism. And the way we create, look, I create magnetic fields. That's what I do. I make all these coils. And believe me, I know way more than anybody can imagine about magnetism, but that doesn't mean that because we think we studied in the early days, again, a lot of the research on magnetism was done at Bell Labs. Bell Labs is one heck of a place, but in New Jersey, but it is, we think we're finished. We do studies in the hidden properties of materials and energy fields, and then we think we're done. But we didn't spend enough time. And where we didn't spend enough time is on magnetic fields, ratios of combined magnetic fields, and the shaping of magnetic fields and the alignment of magnetic fields. We didn't spend enough time there.
Is there any, well, I don't want to, I have another question before I get to the end, but one of the questions I have for you, are there any
here? Because I have to get back to my.
And thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Are there any books you'd recommend? That was a general question, but anything in particular having to do with the subject of magnetic fields, their shapes, their alignments?
Fire is a good book because it shows you the history of the transistor and the use of crystals and magnetic fields. But Crystal Fire refers to one of their sources, which is the physics manual. And I used to have that physics manual, but I lost it. I read it. It's all about the early studies done at Bell Labs. But if you read Crystal Fire, which is sitting right here in front of me, you can get it on Amazon. It'll refer you to the studies at Bell Labs and the name of the book. It's a very expensive book because it's out of print. It's very old, and you have to go. So this book is by Michael Riordan and Lillian Hodison, Crystal Fire, The Birth of the Information Age. And it's all about crystals. And also magnetism. But it's not going to tell you what you need to know about how the UFOs are working. So, but one thing I can tell you is my advice has been, and I have one insider into the Navy UFO system, is they need magnetometers attached to their planes. And when these things go by, we want to measure their magnetic fields. And because we don't see any thrust, we don't see any visible thrust, we don't see any heat in the infrared camera, so we have to check for magnetic fields. And if you see magnetic fields, then I'm right. I know how they're doing this. It's all the way you use magnetism, because magnetism conquers gravity. It will conquer. And it's...
We brushed on it earlier, but do you think there's anything to Marcel Vogel's work?
Oh, of course there is. I mean, it's hard.
What would you recommend his application?
It's hard to duplicate some of his experiments and see any real results, but you have to understand, anybody who's secretive, who makes a major discovery, they'll publicly disclose part of what they know and they'll leave something out. Like, I knew Valerie Hunt for a while before she died, and she told me how they were able to videotape the human aura live, which nobody can do today. Not even the GDV aura camera, I don't believe, is seeing the real aura. It's only seeing the magnetic field. It's not seeing the aura. But Valerie told me how she did it. But when we tried to do it based on what she told me, it didn't work. And I would say Vogel the same. He left out key elements. And why did he do that? Like, why die and take your secrets with you? Well, I guess there's a reason for it. And because when they're alive, they don't want to get ripped off. And then they die unexpectedly, you know. And I was able to talk to Maglitch about helium-3 non-radioactive fusion before he died. And he didn't know he was dying. He said his health was perfect. He was about 87 years old when he died, like Tesla. And Maglitch is from the former Yugoslavia, just like Tesla, actually. And in the FBI files under J. Edgar Hoover on Tesla, Maglitch is named several times in there. So, because they did a whole investigation, the FBI, after Tesla died. But, and I have all those. I read the whole investigation by the FBI. I mean, it should be public.
Thank you so much, David. Hope we can do it again sometime.